This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Stormfront, Book 1 in the Twilight of the Gods series. Written by Christopher G. Nuttall. Performed by Corey Gagne. Prologue, India, 1949.
It's time, Your Excellency.
Winston Churchill, 44th and last Viceroy and Governor General of India, sighed as the functionary entered the office. It was a magnificent office, and Winston knew he would be sorry to leave it. But it wasn't important. The important matter had been decided long ago, in London and Delhi, and Winston's opinions had been dismissed as unimportant. India would be granted her independence, the government in London having decided that a peaceful separation was better than a brutal civil war that would destroy everything Britain had worked so hard to build. The Raj was dead. It had died when Hong Kong and Singapore fell to the Japanese, when Japanese troops had reached the borders of India itself. And Winston Churchill, who had fought so hard to save it, was charged with its funeral. He rose slowly, feeling his old bones creaking under the weight. It had been years since he'd been a reporter, years since he'd served as a soldier, years since he'd been able to keep up with the younger men. The boundless determination that had driven him onwards, through years in the political wilderness and 3 years as prime minister, as Hitler's armies scored victory after victory, was fading. He had hoped, prayed, to go to his rest after the Nazi beast was slain in its lair, but he knew he wouldn't live to see it. Hitler's enemies had fallen before him one by one. Stalin assassinated during the retreat from Moscow, de Gaulle killed by a sniper's bullet in Indochina, Roosevelt felled by his own heart. Winston was the last to survive, and he knew it wouldn't be long before he too was lowered into the grave. And the hopes and fears of the free peoples of the world would die with him. Perhaps not, he thought, as he looked up at the map. Hitler may yet overreach himself. He had never admitted, not even to his wife, just how much he'd hoped Hitler would declare war on the United States. Roosevelt had done all he could, but America couldn't, wouldn't, enter the war against Germany without good cause. Winston had no illusions about what would have happened to the British Empire, overshadowed by its mightier cousin across the ocean. Yet Nazi Germany would have been crushed. Instead, Hitler had declared war on Japan, a stunt that had fooled no one, but had been treacherously difficult to overcome. He'd even withdrawn the U-boats from the Atlantic, gambling that it would avoid an incident that would bring America into the war. And he'd been right. Winston shook his head, silently tracing the lines on the map. Hitler's armies had fallen back from Moscow, true, only to resume the offensive in the following spring. The Russians, their armies faltering as their industry staggered under the weight of the war, couldn't keep Hitler from seizing Stalingrad, then resuming the drive on Moscow. And if that hadn't been bad enough, Hitler's forces had thrust into Egypt and then Palestine. If the Americans hadn't moved troops into Iran, as part of an agreement to withdraw the Anglo-French occupation force, Winston knew that they might have stabbed into India itself. The weakness of the British Empire had been exposed for all to see. And now he sits, consolidating his gains, while we have to struggle to survive, he thought, as he followed the functionary down the stairs. He doubted Hitler could hold Russia indefinitely, although the horror stories from refugees had made it clear that the Nazis were far more brutal than the communists. But there was no one left on the continent who could challenge him. He may even start preparing to launch an invasion of Britain. Outside, the hot air slapped him in the face as he made his way towards the podium. Hundreds of thousands of people were gathered, watching and waiting for the moment when Britain finally granted India her independence, when they could set foot on the world stage as an independent country. Winston couldn't really blame the Indians for wanting independence. Thankfully, the looming threat of the Germans had forced the INC to come up with a reasonable plan for governing the country. But, at the same time, he couldn't help feeling a pang for everything that would be lost. The Raj had been a proud achievement, bringing government and civilization to India. Winston stopped in front of the podium and looked down. The Indians were waiting, dark men in sober white suits. Beside them, diplomats from the rest of the world watched with great interest, flanked by reporters ready to jot down whatever he said and misquote it to the world. Winston had been a reporter himself once upon a time, but his time in the political wilderness had left him with little love for the breed. The age of the daring reporter, along with the brave explorer who brought civilization to the natives, was over. Instead, there were hacks, liars, and bureaucratic bean counters. The glories of the past were long gone. He cleared his throat and stumbled through the speech Prime Minister Attlee had written for him. It was a cumbersome thing, clearly written and approved by committee. It was hard, so hard, to put any of his passion into his words. But it was what the Indians wanted to hear, and they cheered loudly as he told them that India was, from this moment forward, an independent dominion of the British Commonwealth. Thankfully, they'd agreed to stay in the Commonwealth for at least 5 years. The British government had that long to convince them to stay permanently.
"But there is another matter I must discuss," he said, putting the paper notes aside.
He hadn't told Attlee that he intended to add his own words to the speech before the world's reporters, and the assembled world leaders and diplomats. It would only have upset him.
"The world is not what it used to be."
He took a breath.
"When I was a young man, a quarter of the world was red, and the sun never set on the British Empire. I remember campaigning along the northwest frontier and fighting a war in South Africa, never dreaming that the glories before me would come to an end. It never crossed my mind that Europe would destroy itself in war, nor did it occur to me that a great beast would rise from the ashes to enslave the entire continent. I would have thought it impossible if someone had told me, and laughed in his face. But I would have been wrong. An iron curtain has descended across Europe, yet we may still see glimmers of the horrors unleashed by Adolf Hitler. A dozen nations have simply ceased to exist. Countless populations have been enslaved or exterminated by the black-clad SS. Those who dare resist are subjected to torture before they are killed. A horror has descended that holds all of Europe, even Germany itself, in the grip of fear. I remember when the cabinet debated what to do, the day that Hitler's troops marched into the Rhineland and dared us to evict them. If we had known then what we know now, we would have gone to war and forced the Germans to retreat. But we did nothing. I remember when Hitler demanded the most valuable regions of Czechoslovakia and Chamberlain, a weak man, chose to appease the fascist beast rather than make a stand. We allowed Czechoslovakia to be dismembered, and in doing so, sacrificed our best chance to stop Hitler without major bloodshed. But we lacked the nerve to make a stand. We had our excuses, of course. Britain lost nearly 1 million lives in the first Great War against Germany. The French lost nearly twice that, and had their country devastated by the war. Our economies were weak, our forces ill-prepared, and Hitler seemed to hold the moral high ground. Anything seemed better than war. But all that matters in the end was that when we determined to take a stand, we had already surrendered far too much to the Germans. When the phony war ended, Hitler's forces smashed France and pushed Britain to the wall. Had Hitler focused more on naval matters, Britain, too, might have been invaded and occupied. Instead, we were forced to watch as Hitler overwhelmed Russia and the Middle East. There is a temptation, on this day of all days, for us to forget the threat posed by the Germans. There is a temptation to believe that Hitler is satisfied, that he will be happy with what he has taken by force. There is even a temptation to be pleased that the communist regime that dominated Russia has been destroyed.
He paused, silently cursing the American industrialists under his breath. They'd hated communism. And, after Finland, they hadn't been alone. Sending supplies to Britain was one thing, yet sending supplies to Russia was quite another. They had hoped the communists would be destroyed, but what they'd got in exchange might destroy them.
"We can never relax," Winston said. "Right now, Herr Hitler is experimenting with jet aircraft, with atomic weapons, with rockets that will allow him to target New York or land a man on the moon. It would be dangerously reckless of us to assume that the threat will go away, even if we do nothing to provoke it. We must stake out our perimeter, establish our defenses, and never, ever drop our guard until the day the fascist beast is slain in its lair. There can be no compromise with evil," he concluded. "The Nazis will never be satisfied until they have overrun the entire world. And so we must remember, at all costs, that freedom is something that must be defended. Europe forgot that, and now Europe is lost. I charge you all to remember that, when they start trying to soothe us. We must hold the line, or we will all be lost."
He stepped back from the podium as the crowd burst into cheers, wondering just how many of them would understand what he'd said. Far too many Indians considered democracy a joke, and who was to say they weren't wrong? India had seen very little democracy under the Raj, but they'd see less of it under Hitler. The Nazis wouldn't hesitate to do whatever it took to crush resistance. Attlee wouldn't be happy, Winston knew. It was unlikely he'd be offered another government post in the future, but he'd assumed the Labour government wouldn't have a use for him in any case. He was, after all, an embarrassing old lion, a relic of the past. But as long as he lived, he would do what he could to alert the world to the dangers of Nazism. He could do naught else. Chapter 1. Berlin, 17 July, 1985. Victory Day. It was, Finance Minister Hans Kruger concluded darkly, a very impressive parade. He stood with the other ministers, one arm raised in salute, as endless rows of tanks, armored personnel carriers, and mobile missile launchers drove down the parade route and past the stand, before being carefully directed to staging areas on the outskirts of Berlin. The crowd roared its approval as the vehicles passed, followed by thousands upon thousands of soldiers wearing their fanciest uniforms. They'd have no trouble finding companionship tonight, Hans thought wryly, as the soldiers vanished into the distance. All the nice German girls loved a man in uniform, particularly if he were unmarried. Not now, he told himself firmly as the crowd roared again. Not on Victory Day. He twisted his head slightly as a dull roar echoed over the city. A trio of heavy bombers, capable of flying from Berlin to Washington without refueling, flew overhead, so low he almost felt as if he could reach up and touch them. They were followed by a force of fighter jets, anti-aircraft missiles slung under their wings. They, in turn, were followed by a small flock of assault helicopters, freshly painted after their return from the front. The crowd went wild with delight. He smiled to himself as he saw a line of uniformed schoolboys breaking ranks to wave at the aircraft as they passed overhead. Their teachers wouldn't be happy. Discipline was everything in a parade. But hopefully, they'd let it pass.
"Little brats," Foreign Minister Engelhard Rubarth muttered. "Can't they stand in line like everyone else?"
"They're 8, Hans told him dryly. The boys would have been gotten out of bed at 6 in the morning, forced to don their dress uniforms and march to their spot in the square, where they'd then had to wait while standing in line for hours. He still had nightmares about his time at school, even though he'd been lucky enough to avoid a Victory Day parade.
"Let them be children. Just for a while." "They're disrupting the parade," Rubarth said. "The teachers will be furious." I don't envy them tomorrow, Hans agreed. They'll be spending half the day running laps around the school.
He made a mental note to have a word with the parade organizer about the children, although he knew it might be nothing more than tilting at windmills. Everything must be in order, they'd say. It had been a principle of the state since Adolf Hitler had become Chancellor of Germany and set out to reshape the world in his image. Clearly, they'd never seen the confused mishmash of ministries that made up the government. When he'd been younger and more idealistic, Hans had planned a cull of government officers. Older and wiser, he knew there was no way to streamline the system. Too many people had a vested interest in keeping the system as it was. Another pair of aircraft flew overhead, disgorging a line of black-suited figures that fell towards the ground. Hans knew the whole routine had been carefully rehearsed, but he couldn't help feeling a flicker of doubt as the figures kept falling, without even trying to open the chutes. And then, in perfect unison, the chutes popped. The parachutists slowed their fall and landed neatly in front of the Führer's box.
Heil Bormann, they snapped.
The crowd picked up the salute and repeated it.
Heil Bormann!
The Führer seems pleased, Rubarth said.
Good, Hans muttered. Adolf Bormann might be the son of Martin Bormann, but he lacked his father's political skills. Führer wasn't precisely a meaningless title these days. Not when an entire continent saluted him every day. Yet Adolf Bormann had little real power of his own. And he didn't even have the sense to know it.
That will keep him pleased.
He turned his attention back to the parachutists, just in time to see them turn, fold up their chutes and march off, still in perfect unison. Moments later, a long line of soldiers marched into the square, turning to salute the Führer as they passed. The schoolboys seemed to have lost all sense of discipline. They were waving and shouting at the soldiers, some even dropping into line beside them. Hans winced inwardly as a stern-faced teacher came forward, his face darkening with fury. He'd be blamed for their poor conduct by his own superiors, and probably wind up being dispatched to Germany East. It was rare for a teacher to volunteer to serve in Germany East. Hans sighed, then waved to one of his aides.
Yes, mein Herr?
Go tell that teacher he is not to punish the children too severely, Hans said.
He was one of the three most powerful men in the Reich. What was the point of having power if it couldn't be used?
And then see to it that he doesn't suffer too badly himself.
Yes, mein Herr, the aide said.
You always were sentimental, Rubarth commented as the aide scurried away. That's how it begins, you know. The problems the Americans had in the 60s started with a lack of discipline.
And yet the Americans are richer than us, Hans pointed out.
It was an old argument, one he'd found himself repeating to both the military and the SS. If the Americans were so weak and feeble, why were they the ones who had established the first true settlement on the moon, or developed the first anti-ballistic missile shield?
How does that square with a lack of discipline?
The Americans are protected by the ocean, Rubarth countered. That, too, was part of the argument.
They wouldn't stand a chance if we could cross the waters.
Hans shrugged. Very few in the Reich would admit it. But the Americans were more advanced than the Reich. Maybe they did pour fewer resources into their militaries than the Reich, yet their advanced weapons more than even the balance. What was the point of investing in thousands of ICBMs if the Americans could stop more than half of the missiles before they reached their targets? The cost of trying to keep up with the United States was draining the Reich dry. And their educational system is better than ours, too, he thought, as he watched his aide quietly explaining the facts of life to the teacher. They actually teach their children to think. He pushed the thought aside as another flight of aircraft roared over the city. There would be time enough for the endless argument tomorrow. Today was a special day. Weakling, Reichsführer SS Karl Holliston thought, as he watched the interplay between Hans Kruger's aide and the teacher. In Germany East,
Such behavior would never be tolerated for a moment. He sighed, briefly considering sending an aide of his own to the school. A formal complaint from the SS would be enough to get the teacher sacked and the children severely punished. But it would be nothing more than spite. The Berliners hadn't faced war for 40 years, since the last time the British had bombed the city before coming to an uneasy peace with the Reich. Even a handful of bombs planted by particularly foolish Gastarbeiters hadn't disturbed the peace of the city. The Berliners simply didn't know the true danger of living on a frontier. The little brats should all be sent to spend a year in Germany East, he thought darkly. It would seem an adventure, at first, until they realized that a terrorist sniper could strike at any moment. They don't have the mindset to survive. He gritted his teeth in outrage. He'd grown up in Germany East. His father, an SS trooper who'd been granted a farm in the settlements at the conclusion of his service. His mother, a stout German woman who'd already buried a husband who'd been killed by the insurgents and brought 2 children to her second marriage. Not that Karl's father had cared. He'd been happy to bring up an additional son and daughter. Repopulating the steppes with good Germans was more important than his personal feelings, after all. Karl had grown up knowing he might have to fight for his life at any moment, learning to shoot almost as soon as he could walk. And by the time he'd left school and volunteered for the SS, he'd been shot at several times by the insurgents. How many of the bratty schoolchildren below could say the same? None of them, Karl told himself. They grew up in safety. He pushed the thought aside as the first row of SS troopers marched into the square. They were a magnificent sight. Hundreds of black-clad men, their insignia glittering under the light, marching in perfect unison. It was men like them, Karl told himself, who were the true defenders of the Reich. The army, as powerful as it was, didn't have the same determination to do whatever it took to protect the country. Hadn't Rommel proved that when he'd captured Jerusalem? The treacherous field marshal had even allowed the Jewish defenders to withdraw, with their weapons, and escape to Iraq. Rommel simply hadn't the stomach to do what needed to be done. "Heil Bormann!" the troopers bellowed, saluting. "Heil Bormann!" Karl kept his face expressionless with an effort. Adolf Bormann was an idiot, plain and simple, and the deputy Führer was even worse. They should both have been put out to pasture long ago. Giving the title of Führer, the title that had been practically defined by Adolf Hitler himself, to an idiot, was an insult. But it couldn't be helped. No one really wanted a true Führer, one with the power of life and death over the entire Reich, save, perhaps, for Karl. And he only wanted to be the Führer himself. If they let me claim that power, he thought, his eyes seeking Kruger. The fat man was watching the SS troopers with wary eyes. I will be opposed by the rest of the trio. Karl ground his teeth in silent frustration. The finance minister fought tooth and nail over every funding request, doling out money as carefully as a farm wife who distrusted the local tradesman. Kruger wouldn't let Karl become a real Führer without a fight, and he'd be supported by the military, who wouldn't be pleased at the thought of an SS Führer. The Heer, Kriegsmarine, and the Luftwaffe only agreed on a handful of things, but disapproval of the SS was one of them. Karl knew, without false modesty, that he could split the different military commanders on smaller issues. The Heer, Kriegsmarine, and the Luftwaffe heads fought each other with more determination than they fought the rebels in South Africa. Yet they'd unite against the SS. Kruger, damn him, wouldn't need to call in any favors or strike bargains to block Karl from claiming the topmost position in the Reich. He leaned forward as row upon row of SS stormtroopers passed through the square, silently gauging the crowd's reactions. The younger children were still cheering loudly, but there was something forced about the cheers from the older civilians. Karl had no illusions about the popularity of the SS, yet it still bothered him. The vast majority of recruits came from Germany East, where the SS was genuinely popular, but it wasn't enough. He simply didn't have enough recruits to meet the state's manpower needs in peacetime, let alone with a war on in South Africa. "And the war has to be won," he told himself grimly. The Dark Continent was an untapped treasure trove of raw materials, and he had no intention of leaving it to black communists and American capitalists. No matter the cost, the war has to be won. But it was a problem. There had always been questions raised about the racial purity of Germany South. The settlers there didn't give a damn about someone's ancestry, as long as he looked white, and they resisted any attempt by the SS to hunt down rogue Jews, let alone someone who might be French or Italian, pretending to be of good German stock. And South Africa wasn't much better. They'd been happy to accept the Reich's offer of military assistance, but they'd flatly refused to hand over their Jews to the SS. Indeed, Karl was sure that senior figures in the South African government had been encouraging the Jews to flee before it was too late. "Maybe we should just decapitate the local government and take over," he thought. There was a contingency plan to do just that, one he'd been putting together as a last resort. That, at least, would make it easier for us to fight the war.
"The Nazis do put on a good show, don't they?"
Andrew Barton, Office of Strategic Services, nodded in agreement. It was an impressive parade, all the more so for being something he would never have seen in America. The Nazis wanted to show their might off to the world, displaying their power for all to see. It just didn't happen in Washington. "Take careful note of the number of aircraft you see at any one time," he said dryly. A decade ago, a team of American observers had been fooled into believing that the Reich had over 100 intercontinental bombers when the Germans had flown the aircraft over Berlin and then circled around out of sight to fly over the city for a second time. "We don't want to be fooled again." He looked down at the crowds from the balcony, wondering absently just how many of them truly wanted to be there. The kids in the front rows might have thought it was going to be fun, but he doubted they were enjoying themselves after waiting in line for hours. Behind them, the lines of watching civilians seemed slightly disorderly, as if the crowd was already bored and resentful. That, too, wasn't something he'd have seen in Washington. If there had been a parade, attendance sure as hell wouldn't be compulsory. The crowd would have been composed of men and women who wanted to be there, waving flags and cheering loudly.
"Ah,"
Robert Hamilton said. The CIA operative leaned forward. "The meat of the matter." Andrew leaned forward, too, as the first of the heavy mobile missile launchers made its way onto the square. It was a truly impressive sight, he had to admit. The giant vehicle, the missile mounted on its back, inching forward as the crowd went wild. The Nazis had claimed, in their boastful speeches, that the mobile missile could be fired from anywhere within the Reich and hit the United States, although Andrew was fairly sure that was nothing more than empty bragging. Unless the Germans had made a radical breakthrough, the rocket simply didn't have the fuel to fly further than 1,500 kilometers. Not that that kept it from being a major headache, he had to admit. England was easily within range, and the Germans had enough nukes to turn the United Kingdom into a radioactive slag heap. The ABM shield simply couldn't guarantee it would stop even half of the salvo from reaching its target.
"I was thinking," Hamilton said, "do you think they've left the nuke in the rocket?"
Andrew shrugged. The Germans would have to be insane to take the risk, no matter how many safeguards they'd worked into the warhead, but the Germans were the only people to ever use a nuke in combat. On the other hand, nukes didn't go off if you hit them with a hammer. It was quite possible that the warhead was completely safe, no matter what happened. But they'd still have to be insane to mess around with a nuke. He turned his attention toward the podium at the other side of the square. The Führer was there, exchanging salutes with the missile crew.
The Reichsführer SS, one of the most evil men Andrew had ever met, was sitting just 2 seats down from him. If something happened in the parade, the Reich would be deprived of both its titular head and one of its most powerful men. It was hard to be sure just how powerful the other casualties were. In the Reich, power and title didn't always go together, but a disaster would throw the entire state into confusion. If nothing else, the SS will be holding competitions to see who is evil enough to become the next Reichsführer SS, Andrew thought darkly. The winner might be a treacherous, unprincipled bastard with a goatee he can stroke at particularly evil moments. He shook his head, annoyed at himself. He could make fun of the Reichsführer SS. God knew there were hundreds of old WW2 cartoons still running around the internet that made fun of Hitler, Himmler, and Fatso Göring. But none of the people below dared say a word against the Führer and his cronies. The military might marching through the square was one thing, yet the true horror lay in the hundreds of thousands of listening ears, ready to report a single word against the state. Wives could turn on husbands, children on parents. Nazi Germany was a nightmare few ever escaped. And I will go back to America when my stint is up and wash the stench of Nazi Germany from my clothes, he added silently. The people below me are trapped. They'll be running more soldiers and machines through the square tomorrow, Hamilton observed as the final set of tanks rumbled past. Hopefully they'll get themselves some more watchers, too. We have to be back, Andrew said, feeling another stab of pity for the children. He checked his notebook, where he'd scribbled down a brief report on what he'd seen. He'd write out a full report once they returned to the embassy. You want to go get a beer? I'd sooner go find out what's under those uniforms, Hamilton said. Andrew followed his gaze and saw a handful of blonde-haired women wearing strikingly ugly and shapeless clothes. They were army nurses, he thought. German girls are hotter than hell. And you'll be in hell if the ambassador catches you in one of them, Andrew pointed out. It wouldn't be the first honey trap the Nazis had tried, either. Let's go get a beer instead. Chapter 2 Josef Mengele Hospital, Berlin 17 July, 1985 Victory Day.
Are you sure you want to do this?
Gudrun Wieland took a long breath. Her heart was pounding so loudly she was sure her older brother could hear the sound. She wanted to do it, needed to do it, but she knew they could easily get in deep trouble. Their father's belt would be the least of their concerns.
I'm sure, she said.
She braced herself. It would be easy to back out, to walk away. They could be back home within 20 minutes if they walked fast. But she'd gone to a great deal of trouble to borrow a nurse's uniform from a friend, just so she could wear it while walking into the hospital. No one would question her if she wore a uniform, she'd been told. No one, not even the senior doctors, would know every nurse in the building. There were over 1,000 young women and, with the current fashion for blonde hair, it was a reasonable bet that 3/4 of them would be blonde, too. She'd scrubbed her face clean of makeup, tied up her hair, and removed anything that might identify her. As long as they weren't caught in the building, it was unlikely that anyone would be able to track them down afterwards. But Kurt...
Are you sure? She asked.
I can go alone if necessary.
I can't let you go alone, Kurt Wieland said.
Her brother ran a hand through his short blonde hair, cut very close to the scalp. I'm not expected back at the barracks until tomorrow morning. Gudrun gave him a grateful smile. She'd known when she'd asked him that he could have simply refused or reported her to their father. Hermann Wieland wasn't a bad man. She knew friends who had worse fathers, mainly drunkards like Grandpa Frank. But he would have exploded with rage if Kurt had told him what his eldest daughter had in mind. Instead, Kurt had insisted on coming with her and providing support. He'd even helped her sort out what to do when she walked into the building.
Thank you, she said quietly.
Then let's go, Kurt said. He caught her arm as they started to walk towards the hospital. Remember, you're meant to be escorting me, not the other way around.
Gudrun allowed herself a nervous smile. Kurt was wearing his uniform, marking him out as a soldier in the Berlin Guard. It was unlikely that anyone would question his presence, not when the uniform practically screamed his legitimacy to the skies. The cover story they'd devised had her escorting him to see a friend in the hospital, which wasn't too far from the truth. And if someone thought they were lovers, well, as embarrassing as it was, it would be better than the alternative. Being caught would get them both in very hot water. She gritted her teeth as they walked down towards the hospital and through the gates. It was a colossal building, constructed during the 1950s, and staffed with the finest doctors and nurses in Germany. Her friend had told her that there were hundreds of departments. The original building was practically buried in the outbuildings that were half hidden behind other outbuildings themselves. The country had a fetish for efficiency, or so she'd been taught at school, but there was nothing efficient about Josef Mengele Hospital. It was far too obvious that the designers hadn't anticipated just how many doctors and patients would need to use the facilities. The guards paid no attention to them as they walked through the door and into the lobby, heading straight towards the locked doors. Gudrun allowed herself a sigh of relief as they joined a dozen nurses heading through the doors, the leaders holding the doors open for the others. If they had to wait for someone to open the doors, it would have been far too revealing, she knew. Her friend had flatly refused to hand over an ID card that would open the doors. Inside, it was surprisingly cool. Gudrun sniffed the air, the scent of antiseptic bringing back memories of the last time she'd visited a hospital, then looked around for the wall-mounted map of the giant complex. There were hundreds of wards, some identified in medical terminology she couldn't even begin to interpret, others merely identified by a number. She scanned the display quickly, hunting for the number she'd been given. Somehow, she wasn't entirely surprised to discover it was on the far side of the building, well away from the entrance. Cold ice ran down her spine as she looked up at her brother. He was frowning. "They've got something to hide," he murmured. "That ward is pretty well concealed." Gudrun nodded in agreement, then checked the map, memorizing the route. Map reading wasn't one of the skills she'd learned in the Hitler Youth. Young women were expected to learn how to cook, clean, and have babies. But she didn't dare risk asking for directions as they walked deeper into the facility. Anyone with a legitimate reason to be there would know their way around the building, or, if they were just visiting for a day, would be assigned an escort. She glanced back at her brother, then led the way down the corridor. The hundreds of doctors and nurses, some of the latter somehow managing to make their ugly blue uniforms look fashionable, ignored them. Kurt was right, she thought ruefully. Just how long had she spent scrabbling with her older brother as a young girl? It had taken her far too long to realize that Kurt had grown into an adult. As long as we look as though we fit in, no one will pay any attention to us. She concentrated on finding her way through the corridors as Kurt followed her, no doubt keeping track of their route himself. He'd have learned to read a map in the Hitler Youth. He wouldn't have been promoted so quickly, she was sure, if he hadn't mastered the basics at a very early age. But then, young men were taught military skills in the Hitler Youth. She'd always envied the boys when they'd gone camping, leaving school for a week of mountain climbing, mock exercises, and other exciting sports. They'd even been allowed to play with real weapons. Gudrun and the other girls had never even been allowed to see a gun in school. They turned the corner and walked towards the ward. A pair of SS troopers were on guard, but neither of them looked particularly alert. Gudrun walked forward, keeping her face utterly expressionless, as she led Kurt past the guards and into the wards. The troopers gave her an appreciative look, but made no move to stop her. This far inside the building,
They probably assumed that anyone they saw had the right to be there. She fought down a smile, knowing that they'd just crossed the Rubicon, and started to look for a specific bed. They didn't dare loiter where the troopers could see them. Kurt poked her arm. "There," he said, pointing to the wall. A chart was mounted on it, showing a list of names and beds. "See if you can find him there." Gudrun nodded and peered up at the chart. There were over 2 dozen names on the list, all completely unfamiliar, bar one. Unterscharfuhrer Konrad Schulze, her boyfriend. Unterscharfuhrer Konrad Schulze, who had asked her to marry him when he returned from South Africa. Unterscharfuhrer Konrad Schulze, who had returned from South Africa and vanished into the Josef Mengele Hospital. She felt an odd twist in her heart as she stared at the name, realizing that Konrad hadn't left her. His family, she'd discovered, were as much in the dark as herself. Their son had gone to war and then... She gritted her teeth as she looked for the right bed. It had been sheer dumb luck she'd heard anything. A friend of hers, the same girl who'd loaned her the nurse's uniform, had seen Conrad's name and SS number on a list of patients in the hospital. Gudrun hadn't believed her at first. His family hadn't been told he'd been wounded and sent home, let alone allowed to see him, but as weeks went by without a single letter from a normally attentive boyfriend, she'd started to have suspicions. And then it had taken 2 weeks of scheming to plan an unauthorized visit to the hospital. If Kurt hadn't agreed to accompany her, it would have been impossible. And no one had heard anything from the bureaucracy. Gudrun scowled in bitter memory. She'd thought Conrad's family liked her, for all that she was a university-educated student rather than a proper little housewife. They'd certainly never sought to discourage their son from courting her. Hell, it had been her friends who'd raised eyebrows at the thought of dating an SS trooper. The university students had never got along with the SS, who would happily close the university down in an instant if they thought they could get away with it. But Konrad had been different. He'd been sweet and funny, and never tried to press himself on her. The thought of his kisses made her lips tingle. And, if they knew something had happened to him, they would have told her. She paused, just outside the curtains enshrouding his bed. All of a sudden, she wasn't sure she wanted to take the final step, to brush aside the curtains and see her lover. What if she was wrong? What if it wasn't him? Or, what if something had happened? "Go," Kurt urged quietly. "We may not have long." Gudrun reminded herself firmly that she came from a brave family and pushed the curtain aside, then froze in horror at the sight that greeted her eyes. Her boyfriend was lying on his side, hooked up to a machine that bleeped worryingly every 5 seconds. The lower half of his body was completely gone. She had only taken basic medicine at school. It was another skill girls were required to learn. But she honestly wasn't sure how he'd survived. His face was bruised and broken. Indeed, for a long moment, she was honestly convinced that they'd made a dreadful mistake and opened the wrong set of curtains. But he had the scar on his chest she recalled from one of their lovemaking sessions, and his SS tattoo on the underside of his right arm matched the one she'd memorized. "They tattoo our ID number and blood group so we can be treated in a hurry," Konrad had told her once. She felt sick as she recalled the handsome young man she'd courted, the man who'd gone to war. "And it's a badge of honor." "Jesus," Kurt said, peering past her. "How the hell is he going to give Mama grandchildren?"
"Shut up,"
Gudrun hissed. She couldn't help peeking at where Conrad's genitals should have been. But they were gone. Whatever had happened to him, it had taken everything below his hips. She honestly had no idea how he was still alive.
"Do you think we can wake him?"
Kurt grabbed her arm.
"Don't even think about it."
Gudrun winced in pain, but she had to admit he was right. She didn't have the slightest idea how to wake Conrad, if it were possible. Removing him from the machine might kill him outright. They would almost certainly set off alarms, bringing real doctors and nurses running to the bed. They'd be smoked out, caught and arrested. And after that, Gudrun wasn't sure, but sending them back to their father would be far too lenient for the SS. They'd probably be exiled to Germany East. If half of the rumors were true, no one ever came back alive. I should have married him, she thought, looking down at Conrad. It was far from illegal to get pregnant out of wedlock. The state would happily pay expectant mothers a small stipend for carrying another young German to term. But her mother would have been furious if Gudrun had allowed herself to get pregnant. If I had... She swallowed hard. Conrad wouldn't be making love to her anytime soon, let alone returning to the war. Doctors could perform miracles these days, but she doubted they could rebuild his legs, let alone his genitals. She'd heard stories about how sperm could be mined from a male body and then inserted into a female body, impregnating the woman, yet... She shuddered at the thought. It sounded terrifyingly unnatural. Conrad would probably die in a hospital bed, if he couldn't live without life support, or spend the rest of his life in a wheelchair like Grandpa Frank, drinking heavily and nursing his sorrows. She winced at the thought. She didn't like Grandpa Frank, even if he was her maternal grandfather, and then stepped away from the bed. Part of her wanted to stay with him, but she knew what would happen if she tried. The SS would take her away and... They wanted to cover this up, she thought. Conrad was from an SS family. His father had been a trooper before retiring, and yet they'd been lied to by the state. They wanted to conceal his wounds. It didn't make sense, she told herself. Conrad wasn't anyone important. His family didn't have ties to the Reichstag. But instead of reporting his wounds to his family, the SS had tried to hide them. She tossed it over and over in her head, remembering what her father had said about his work as a policeman. If someone was trying to hide something, he'd said, it meant they had something to hide that justified the effort of hiding it. And yet, Conrad wasn't anyone important. There was no reason to hide his wounds. Take Conrad out of the equation, she told herself. There was nothing important about Conrad, therefore no one would waste the effort solely for him. And you get... She looked up. There had been more than 24 names on the list, and in the ward there were 24 beds, each one hidden behind a set of curtains. If each one of them held a wounded soldier, and it looked as though they did, what did it mean? The news kept claiming that German troops, bringing fraternal aid to their brothers in South Africa, were winning the war. But if someone was concealing the sheer number of wounded troops, what did that say about the progress of the war, and how many troops had wound up dead in South Africa? They're lying, she thought. She had always been dimly aware that the news services were run by the government, that nothing was ever broadcast without government approval, but she'd never fully understood what that meant. They're lying about the war. She jumped as she heard someone clearing her throat. What are you two doing in here? Gudrun turned. A young nurse, a senior nurse, judging from the gaudy rank badges on her uniform, was standing behind them, hands on hips. She looked as stern as their mother when she'd caught them in the biscuit box back when they'd been children. Gudrun couldn't help thinking that she would have been pretty if she'd let her hair down and, perhaps, worn something a little more fitting. The uniform was just plain ugly. I convinced Nurse Gudrun to let me see my friend Conrad after my own examination. Kurt lied smoothly. It wasn't as if Gudrun was an uncommon name. There had been 3 other girls with the same name in junior school. We served together in South Africa, don't you know? He saved my life 2. He leaned forward. If you're charged with his care, perhaps you can tell me how he is. I'd be most grateful. The nurse frowned.
You shouldn't have brought him in here without permission, she said, addressing Gudrun. Visitors have to be cleared through security.
It's my fault, beautiful, Kurt said. He cocked his head.
Can I take you for a drink later?
Perhaps, the nurse said. She looked downcast for a long moment.
Your friend is unlikely to survive without the life support machine, sir. The brain damage was quite severe, and the medical care he received in the theater was quite poor. We dug quite a few pieces of shrapnel out of his flesh, but by then it was really too late. His body is still alive, if barely. His brain is dead.
Gudrun swallowed the question she wanted to ask. She didn't dare draw the nurse's attention back to her, even as Kurt flirted and the nurse, insanely, seemed inclined to respond. Perhaps, being a nurse, she didn't have many chances for romance. Or, more likely, she thought a soldier would understand long hours and short tempers. Her father had once told her that policemen preferred to marry nurses.
You escort him to the doors, then report to the security office, the nurse said finally. I have work to do here.
Of course, Gudrun said.
She had no intention of doing anything but walking out the doors with Kurt, removing the uniform as soon as possible, and never returning.
I'm sorry.
Go, the nurse ordered.
That was a close one, Kurt muttered, once they were past the guards. But at least I got her number.
Gudrun gave him a disbelieving look.
You do realize you can't possibly call her.
That's not the point, Kurt said. The point is that I got her number.
He didn't say anything else until they walked through the doors and escaped into the streets, heading towards a flat belonging to a friend. Their father would have asked far too many questions if Gudrun had returned home wearing a nurse's uniform, and, being a cop, was far too practiced at sniffing out lies. He would demand the whole story, then explode with fury at the risk they'd taken.
You need to keep this to yourself, he warned. If someone is trying to keep this a secret...
I know the dangers, Gudrun said.
She had a vague plan forming in her mind, but nothing solid, not yet. And she couldn't share her thoughts with her brother.
And I know the risks.
Chapter 3 Reichstag, Berlin, 17 July 1985, Victory Day. There were times, Hans Kruger thought as he walked into the meeting room, that it would probably be easier to handle decisions if the big three met in private, hammered out a set of compromises, and then presented it to the rest of the Reich Council as a fait accompli. It would certainly take less time, with less outraged shouting. But it was impossible. The different branches of the military would certainly want their say, the different government ministries would have their own opinions about matters, and even the SS, for all it tried to present a monolithic face to the world, had its dissidents. There was no way to accommodate them all, save for inviting all the principals to the meetings. And that tends to mean that nothing gets done, he reminded himself sourly. The only consolation was that formal protocol was practically non-existent. By the time we're finished arguing, it's time for dinner, and then we resume arguing after dinner. He sighed inwardly as he sat down and accepted a cup of coffee from the attendants. The remainder of the seats were filling up fast. The uniformed heads of the military, the ministers wearing fancy suits, and the SS clumped together at one end of the table. Hitler might have been a great man. Hans knew better than to think otherwise, even in the privacy of his own mind. But he'd never established a formal governmental structure to handle the vastly expanding Reich. Instead of an organized system, where power and responsibility were roughly equal, he'd presided over 100 different fiefdoms, keeping them at loggerheads so his rule remained unchallenged. And when Hitler died, the wheels had threatened to come off the whole ramshackle structure. And it was sheer luck that Himmler was convinced not to try to seize power for himself, Hans thought, glancing down towards Karl Holliston. The Reichsfuhrer SS would happily seize supreme power if he thought he could get away with it. Then the military would have opposed the SS purely out of instinct. Now, who knows which way everyone will jump? The attendants finished pouring coffee and withdrew, closing the doors behind them with a loud thump. Hans allowed himself a grim smile. They were in the most secure room in the Reich. The security team protecting the complex was the most capable in Germany. And yet, the true threat lay within. Just how many of the men at the table would make a bid for power if they thought they could succeed? Hans wouldn't. He knew how hard it would be to rule the Reich alone. But he had a feeling he was the only one. Everyone else? The lure of supreme power was very alluring. He kept his face impassive as the Führer rose to his feet.
"This meeting is now called to order,"
Adolf Bormann said, turning to face the giant portrait hanging from the wall. Hans had to admit Bormann could give pretty speeches, but little else.
"Heil Hitler!"
"Heil Hitler!" Hans echoed. And everywhere else, it would be Heil Bormann, he thought, as Bormann sat back down. But not here. Not where we can't risk allowing his head to swell.
"I move we address the war in South Africa," Holliston said quickly. "Victory Day has, as always, given us a boost. We must take advantage of it before it is gone."
Hans exchanged glances with Field Marshal Justus Stoffregen, head of OKW, who nodded once. The military, therefore, wanted to discuss the war, too. Hans had a whole folder of economic issues that had to be addressed, but there was no point fighting an unwinnable battle against both the military and the SS. Besides, it would give him an opportunity to let Holliston make his points and then undermine the bastard. The SS man simply didn't understand the cold economic realities that were steadily undermining the Reich. Holliston leaned forward.
"The South African war is approaching a climax," he said, as if he hadn't said the same thing at the last four meetings of the Reich Council. "We have taken losses, but we are pressing the rebel insurgents hard and persistently weakening their grip on their fellow blacks. They are steadily being worn down."
He paused, waiting to see if anyone would object. Hans, who had quite a few private agents reporting to him from South Africa, could have disputed that rosy picture, but he kept his thoughts to himself. Better to let the SS man store up trouble for himself. Besides, he knew all too well what lurked behind the cold figures. Men and women killed, children rounded up and herded into concentration camps, towns and villages burned to the ground for daring to hide insurgents. No wonder the blacks were fighting desperately. They were caught between freedom and total extermination. "And thousands of our own men are dead," he thought coldly. "The general public doesn't have the slightest idea just how many soldiers have been killed, or wounded, in South Africa." It wasn't a pleasant thought, he reflected. The Reich had no elections, no way for the civilians to express their feelings about the war. No one had quite realized just how badly public opinion, such as it was, would be shocked about the Balkan War. The public hadn't given a damn about slaughtered Jews or Muslims, of course. But telling them just how many Germans had been killed in the fighting had been a mistake. It wasn't one the SS intended to repeat.
"However, we have a major problem," Holliston continued. "Pretoria is not as enthusiastic about the war as we would prefer." "Unsurprising," Hans commented dryly. "We are, after all, fighting a savage war of peace on their territory."
Holliston gave him a sharp look.
"We have gathered evidence that suggests the South Africans are on the verge of betraying us," he snapped. "Pretoria has been in private communications with Oliver Tambo and, apparently, attempting to come to some sort of agreement. Furthermore, Tambo and his bunch of terrorists would not have escaped if Pretoria had acted swiftly to reinforce the parachutists who attacked the bastards' territory. I believe they hesitated in the hopes that Tambo would escape."
"And succeeded, if that were the case," Field Marshal Gunter Voss commented.
"They would presumably not have wished to restart negotiations with a new leader," Hans mused. "Tambo was hardly the worst they could have had to deal with."
He scowled inwardly. Pretoria's apartheid system had a great deal in common with the Third Reich,
but the white population of South Africa made up only a tenth of the population. Even though Pretoria had been working hard to lure immigrants from Spain, Italy, France, and even